words of the song go, "It was 20 years ago today, Sergeant Pepper taught his band to play." But of course it was 50 years ago today that Ed Sullivan brought the Beatles on to play. How many saw that? Boy, we're really old now, aren't we? Holy cow. Wow, I was only 2, you know, at the time. It's amazing I could retain so much from such a young age. But you know, that woo that Paul McCartney shouted out during She Loves You came straight from Little Richard. And John Lennon's Shake It Up Baby came straight from the Isley Brothers. And Little Richard and the Isley Brothers came straight from the Black Baptist Church. Of course, now we baby boomers are old enough to be a disappointment to our children. But in general, we are a whole lot less racist than our parents' generation. And music helped. Ours was really the first American generation to popularly listen to music of both black and white popular musicians. And here's a little bit about how that happened. Now, I don't know who Jimi Hendrix's favorite guitar player was. And I don't know who Picasso's favorite artist was, though I suspect it was Picasso. But I do know who Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite preacher was, because he told us. It was the Reverend C.L. Franklin. Clarence Laval Franklin was born in Sunflower County, Mississippi, January 22, 1915. He was about a year older than my father. Sunflower County, Mississippi is on the Mississippi Delta, which is the delta of the Mississippi, strangely enough. C.L. doesn't remember much of his father. He went away to World War I, and when he came back, he abandoned his family shortly thereafter. We don't know what might have happened to C.L.'s father during World War I, but we do know that he abandoned his family. Shortly thereafter, his mother remarried a man named Mr. Franklin, and he took his name. Mr. Franklin was a sharecropper. And you know, the sharecroppers would buy all their seeds and their provision from the company store, and they would sell their crops back, and there would be an accounting every year. And every year, it seemed like the boss told Mr. Franklin, you know, he didn't quite make it. We'll just let it go this year. He didn't quite make it. And each year, he didn't quite make it. And the next year, he didn't quite make it. Every year. When C.L. was a teenager, young teenager, they moved north about 20 miles to Cleveland, Mississippi, and they were still sharecropping, but this new farm was a little bit different. This new farm was next to a highway. It was next to Highway 61. And young C.L., when he was picking cotton and suckering the tobacco plants, he would look on Highway 61, and Highway 61 began in New Orleans, and it went and followed along the Mississippi all the way up to Minnesota. And young C.L. would see people driving north on Highway 61, and there was a railroad track nearby, and he would see the people in the railroad tracks going north, and somehow he thought the people going north looked a little happier than the people who were going south. And he looked on Highway 61, and he wondered where it led. And several generations later, Bob Dylan was up in Minnesota on the north end of Highway 61, wondering where it went to. And it wasn't just C.L. Franklin that looked out on Highway 61 and saw those people looking a little happier going north. There were people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and Howlin' Wolf and all the Mississippi Delta blues greats looked on Highway 61 and wondered where it was going. And now it's called the Blues Highway, and there's a placard for each one of those blues greats. And from an early age, C.L. said, I didn't see much future in farming. He remembers the first time he spoke in public. He was about 7 or 8 years old. And it was an important occasion, and his mother came to school to hear him speak. And the kids being like kids, they were kind of rowdy, and this was the first time C.L. got up to speak. And he was a little shy, and he really didn't get his point across, and he couldn't be heard. So when he got home that night, his mother took out the strap and whipped him and said, boy, the next time you speak, they're going to hear you. And you know what? The next time he spoke, they heard him. And every other time, they heard him. Now, that might not be exactly the classic call to preach, but it seemed to do the job. You know, it was not easy for a black man to be heard in the Mississippi Delta. He would hitchhike north as far as he could go as a young man trying to find a place that would have him to preach. And he would find a Sunday here and a Sunday there, but it seemed like when Sunday was over, he had to go back to Cleveland again. And at one point, his father said, son, you've got to choose to preach or to plow. So this was a powerful incentive on C.L. He was married at the time. And finally, he did find a little church in Memphis, one of the first main stops along Highway 61. He was about 21 years old. He'd already been married a couple of years. And he was minister of that little church in Memphis. And after about 4 years, there came a point to his life that is the most troubling part of C.L. Franklin's life for me, and I suspect for him. Because he was 25 years old, and he fathered a child with a young girl who was a member of his congregation, and she gave birth, she had just turned 13. So when C.L. Franklin preaches about pressing on and putting the things in your past behind you, that there are great things you can do in the future. This was part of his history that he was pressing on. Now, the whole idea of the age of consent was different in Memphis in 1940 than it is now, but still, the role of the black minister in that society, could such a transgression even have been reported then? And if so, to whom would they have reported it? I think it's clear that had the law in Memphis acted, it would either have been to ignore him or to lynch him. The context of the times can excuse many sins. I'm not asking them to be excused, but to be understood, and that young people with proper guidance can redeem lives today and in Memphis in 1940. We do know that rightly or wrongly, the church knew about it and did not seek to remove him. He stayed there until 1944 when he preached the eulogy of a friend in Buffalo, New York. And after hearing him preach the eulogy, the church asked him to stay as their minister. So he moved from Memphis off of Highway 61 and went up to Buffalo, the first time he lived in the north, and he and his wife and young family loved living in Buffalo. He was beginning to get a reputation. He had become active in the national organization. And after only 2 years, he left that church for the most vibrant, exciting, modern, sophisticated city he could imagine, Detroit. He became minister of the Bethel Baptist Church, And he stayed there from 1946 to 1979, and eventually had a membership of over 10,000. I call him Reverend Rhythm and Blues today because of his influence on getting black musicians from the church to the stage in the 1960s. But in his day, he was called Reverend Jitterbug. He was known as the minister who sang. He began his sermons on a biblical topic, but he ended them with what in the Black Baptist tradition is called the whoop. Now, if you've heard Martin Luther King's preach, he just starts to whoop just a little bit, but he knows he's speaking to a lot of Unitarians and things like that. So he only gets to about 2 on a 10 scale of whooping. But I invite you to go on YouTube and search C.L. Franklin. It doesn't have, I haven't been able to find any videos, but it's got a lot of audios of his sermons and hymns, and it's really worth listening to. And at the end, he didn't just whoop, but he sang, and he could really sing, and you don't have to wonder whether he was Aretha Franklin's real father or not. There is no doubt. You know where she got the voice. You know where she got her chops. He would just bring down the house every time. His sermons were on radio going back to his days in Memphis. And by the time he got to Detroit, he was on Clear Channel radio stations. And then he was picked up on WLAC in Nashville on Sunday night. And that was a big deal because WLAC was heard practically to the Philippines. So it's fair to say that from World War II until Dr. King's March on Washington, C.L. Washington's voice was the most widely heard black voice in America. He bridged generations. He was an old school Baptist, but he specifically said, for instance, that the Bible must allow for the teaching of science and evolution. And he enjoyed Saturday night as much as he enjoyed Sunday morning. When B.B. King came to Detroit, C.L. Franklin was in the front row for B.B. King, and B.B. King was in the front row for C.L. Franklin on Sunday morning. And there was a big controversy in about 1952 when C.L. Franklin showed up one Sunday in a conch. Now, y'all know what a conch is? If you've ever seen pictures of Duke Ellington or Nat Cole in the 50s, it's a process. It was a way of making your hair. It's really sort of an elaborate sort of thing, you know. But it was the cool thing that you did in the 50s. If you had hair like Duke Ellington, you know, that was pretty cool. But for a Baptist minister to show up in a conch, that was a big deal. And there were certain outrage at that. And let's just say, he kept the conch. His clothes were expensive and immaculate. And I remember that there's a quote that said, and he didn't just match on Sunday morning, he matched every day of the week. By the 1950s, he was so successful that the Clara Ward Singers asked him to tour with them. Now, this was at the time that the biggest gospel singers would go on tour, and it was a major thing to do that. But with radio and now television starting to come on, it was starting to lose some of its sensation, some of its granditude. And so they thought, Clara Ward thought, if they could get C.L. Franklin to tour with him, the combination of the sermonizing that he was able to do and the gospel music would reinvigorate the whole tour. In other words, the gospel singers needed the sermon and the sermon needed the music on tour, just like they do on Sunday morning. So they did that and they were a huge success. But think of that, it kind of blurred the line between church and entertainment. You know, because they weren't doing this in churches, they were doing it in Madison Square Gardens all over the country. So C.L. would preach in Detroit on Sunday, and then during the week he might go to Atlanta or Baltimore or anywhere that he would tour. And he started making records on what? Chess Records out of Chicago, the same label that all those other Delta musicians recorded on. And they're still selling his albums of hymns and sermons to this day. He would outrage the older generation of Baptist ministers, but they couldn't shun him because he was too popular and he was too good. And he did not, to his credit, shun them. Though he did some outrageous things. For instance, for his 10th anniversary celebration in 1957, he invited a woman minister to sit at the head table. Theodosia Hooks sat right next to him at the head table. And not only was she a woman, she was a Pentecostal, which was beyond the pale for the Black Baptists. You know, the Pentecostals speak in tongues, and we used to call them holy rollers, you know, and the Baptists were much more, you know, classy than that. So to have not only a woman, but a Pentecostal minister, that was almost worse than having a conch. And also at the head table was T-Bone Walker, whose famous song is Stormy Monday. Bobby Blue Bland said specifically he got his singing style from listening to C.L. Washington. So meanwhile, C.L. and his wife had had four children when he was back in Memphis, including Aretha, who was born in 1942. And if you go back and if you go online and look at Aretha Franklin, you can find the place that she was born in Memphis in 1942. And it was either a big shack or a small house, you know, so he wasn't overflowing with affluence when he was back in Cleveland. C.L. separated from his wife in 1948. The children stayed in Detroit, and C.L. brought his mother up from Memphis to take care of him. His wife died in 1952, and C.L. never remarried. But by the age of 14, Aretha Franklin had quit school and was touring with the Clara Ward Singers and her father. And by this time, C.L. Washington and Clara Ward had become quite an item. In fact, C.L. had a lot of items over the years. There was so much musical talent in that time in Detroit. There was a gospel group called the Meditations, and Della Reese sang second lead. When Aretha was touring with her father, there were some other kids who were singing at the Bethel Baptist Church: Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, and Smokey Robinson. There was a charismatic singer who was the leader of the most famous gospel quartet called the Soul Stirrers. His name was Sam Cooke. And Sam Cooke did a most outrageous thing in 1959. This was the most popular, the most famous gospel singer, and he recorded a pop song in 1959 called Lovable. And it was a big hit. And that was almost as bad as C.L. wearing a conch. To have the gospel star cross over and make a pop song. Now, they always say that the way you cross over is you take out the word Lord and put in baby, and that's about right. But what might this mean? What did this really mean? Now, one of CL's items that turned into a very serious relationship was with a woman named Anna Gordy, who had a brother named Barry, who started this record company. And suddenly it seemed like in a matter of a few years, the whole youth choir of Bethel Baptist Church became international recording stars. Now, as talented as these young men and women were, I don't necessarily think that there was more talent in the Black Baptist churches of Detroit than there were in Philadelphia, or Harlem, or Oakland, or Chicago. What Detroit had was Berry Gordy and C.L. Franklin. It's not only talent that's necessary for success, it's the ability to see opportunity, to create opportunity. One of my favorite gospel songs is called, "My Lord, Don't Move No Mountains, But Give Me the Strength to Climb." And it was C.L. Washington that gave the next generation the strength to climb. And he didn't just give that strength to climb to singers and musicians. Now, the older generation of the Black Baptist ministers, the leaders of the church, and therefore the leaders of the Black community, they didn't see the point to what these young ministers were trying to do, who were advocating some sort of thing called nonviolent direct action based on what Gandhi had done a few years earlier in India, which was in turn based on what Thoreau, the Unitarian, had done. And what the older Black ministers would say is that Black folks getting arrested and thrown into jail and getting beat up is not going to touch the conscience of the segregationist. And they were right. But you know how the older generation is. They don't understand the new technology. But C.L. Franklin did, because he'd been on radio and he'd sold records and he'd seen what the kids were capable of doing. So when one of those kids, Martin Luther King, was proposed to lead the entire Black Baptist denomination at age 25, C.L. said, "I'm behind him. He can do it." So just like C.L. linked Saturday night and Sunday morning, he also linked the older generation of Black Baptists to the new young ministers. And so for a very few important years, there was no generation gap in what the Black community was trying to do. They were all behind Dr. King. And this was no small part due because C.L. Franklin said, "You can do it." Now, on June 23rd, 1963, 11 days after Medgar Evers was murdered, and 2 months before the March on Washington, C.L. Franklin organized the biggest civil rights march in history up until that time. Even though some of the older ministers were opposed to it, they relented because Martin Luther King said he'd come. Every class in the Black community marched. The Pentecostals and the Baptists and the street people and the fancy people. That was the key to the success of the Civil Rights Generations movement. Everybody in the community was behind it. Once the classes and the generations divided in the Black community, just as in the white community, progress stalled. Now, the opening ceremonies at that march featured Ramsey Lewis, Dinah Washington, Jimmy McGriff, and the Four Tops. And Martin Luther King preached a sermon called "I Have a Dream." It went over pretty well. So he thought he'd use it again 2 months later. What kind of man was C.L. Franklin? Well, if you're so inclined, there's a lot of gossip on the internet. But I know that Martin Luther King that day began his talk by thanking my friend, C.L. Franklin. And one day, C.L.'s daughter, the daughter whose mother was that young girl back in Memphis, and who was later accepted by the Franklin family, she said, "He was a man. He didn't walk on water. He was a man. He didn't walk on water, but he walked a path from Highway 61 into history. And he helped his generation press on." May you join together in our closing hymn, number 348.